What's up, beautiful people, and welcome back to another episode of The Connect. My name is Ghali and I am your host. And to be honest, I had absolutely no will or motivation to upload an episode today, let alone record this one. I want to begin by sending my prayers to all of the people living the resistance, to the oppressed, the marginalized, the destitute, the people who have had their right to be free trampled upon again and again, to the people who are being persecuted for what they believe in, the people who've had their homes taken away from them, loved ones taken away from them, the people who have their lands exploited in the name of capitalism and imperialism. My thoughts are always with you. I often reflect upon a verse in the Quran where God says that he won't change a condition of a people until we've changed the condition within ourselves. And as a humanity, we have failed a lot of people time and time again. And even if you just stop and think about the community that you're living in right now, how many issues do you see around you every day? How are you directly or indirectly contributing to those issues? Because as much as we would like to believe that we're all like good people or whatever, we all indirectly contribute to a lot of issues. So to the people in Minneapolis and countless cities across the US right now, to the people in many other countries around the world right now, fearlessly standing up against their oppressors, against the system, I salute you for doing what is needed to be done and what is necessary for you to do. Now, today I wanted to talk about, you know, the psychology behind protests and riots and why we're seeing what we're seeing, but I also wanted to sort of expand that later on into, you know, what you can do if you sort of want to make some change in your own communities and the importance of self-care and where I've sort of put resources online. Now, when it comes to these protests and these riots, a lot of people will call the people out there doing what they need to do delinquents, criminals, thugs. But make no mistake that this is not hooliganism, and to label it mindless is not only fallacious, but it allows people to dismiss the accountability for the social inequalities that people have been facing for centuries. People will either paint them as mad mobs or discredit them by labeling them as criminals. What so many people refuse to take into account is the factors, or are the factors, that lead to the situation that we are witnessing unfold in many places. When people protest or riot, their collective behavior is never mindless. Sometimes it may become criminal, but it is structured and coherent with meaning and conscious and intent, and this needs to be understood and heard very well. A lot of conversations around the destruction of property and looting have been coming up. What research has shown through different riots time and time again is that people's actions are usually governed by the individual's shared social identity. For example, in the protests in Minneapolis and what we are seeing now, a large part of people's identity is defined by their united opposition against police brutality. The other part of people's identity governs what happens during protests and riots, where the limits are and who and what can be targeted, an unspoken social code of sorts. So when Congresswoman Ilhan Omar comes out and voices that the people causing destruction in majority Black-owned business areas in Minneapolis are outsiders, what she is alluding to is that we are not protesting and destroying our own property at the same time, because that's absurd, right? There are a lot of anarchists and generally many white rioters destroying property and white supremacists inciting violence and just people who love property destruction, taunting the police and escalating violence that are in the mix of peaceful protesters. But all this aside, Martin Luther King called riots the voice of the unheard. This is the resistance. This is the uprising. It happens everywhere when people can no longer tolerate the disparities they are forced to endure. This doesn't happen out of thin air. When people that have tried absolutely everything else for centuries, when they have been dehumanized, lived in poverty, and deprived of basic rights and equality for 4 centuries, why are we so quick to condemn their violence and not the systems that uphold and perpetuate the violence on their lives every single day? The environment breeds the response, and to expect people to sit there like good little boys and girls and take it is inhuman and a violation of their human rights. I've received messages from people sort of being like, is violence the answer? And I've always replied with, I'm not a pacifist, I'm a Muslim. So justifiable violence when people are defending themselves, yes. And for any Muslims who are out there talking about this is now a problem or whatever it is, it 100% is, because you've been commanded to stand against injustice, so much so that being silent in the face of injustices is a huge no-no, so much so that the grand sin of like gossiping and speaking behind people's backs and things like that is actually permitted in situations where people can't actually speak up. And the only way for people to get information around and to warn each other is through this means of communication. And in the words of John Boyega, I was not raised by no weak people. So I am very much Somali in how I think about justice. And I mean, if you're gonna throw a rock at my house, just be prepared to take it like you dish it, basically. But we're living in a time where we're always on our phones, we're always connected online, information is being transferred across the world at a rate that has never been seen before. And on top of that, a lot of us are locked down because of the pandemic that's ongoing. And so we're constantly living in this negative feedback loop where we can't even go a day without seeing some sort of news that just breaks our heart. So what we're seeing happening around the world, and especially in the States, is this is what rage looks like. And tear gas is not going to address these disparities. If anything, the force and the brutality that the police and other armed forces are using against protesters will enrage them even more and lead to more riots, protests, possibly uprisings, which is exactly what we're seeing unfold. Leaders shouldn't be dismissing this. They should be hearing it well. People are done and tired. How do you expect people to act who have been deemed without value and left behind to fall apart? And as for you, if you're someone on the fence, would you be fine to be subjugated to the conditions that Black people are? I assume that your answer is going to be no. Why not? Think about it. This is happening all around the world due to the same root causes. And I think Nelson Mandela said it the best. As long as poverty, injustice, and gross inequality persist in our world, none of us can truly rest. We're seeing police brutality and extrajudicial killings in Kenya, in South Africa, in Nigeria, to name a few, where people are more afraid of the police than the coronavirus. We are seeing the same agents that were created by white colonialists to keep them safe while they looted and killed, repurposed to protect the corruption of the haves. Everywhere, poor people are being punished for being poor by the people who uphold the systems to keep them there. How does this make any sense? I saw photos of Black Lives Matter protests in Tel Aviv days after IDF soldiers shot and killed an autistic Palestinian man. Black Lives Matter protests in Tel Aviv, where Ethiopian Jews were protesting last July in Israel after 18-year-old Solomon Tekka was killed by an off-duty policeman. Just last year, 12-year-old Shukri Abdi, who had recently moved to the UK from Somalia, was bullied by her classmate and was found drowned in a river in Greater Manchester. The police tried to cover it up. The school tried to cover it up. Her previous classmates haven't even been brought to justice. And an inquest earlier this year actually showed witness testimony that said that the kids told her, if you don't get into the water, I'm going to kill you. don't think that what's happening in America is exclusively an American problem. The black struggle against white supremacy is a global one. I was there in 2011 when people rioted and looted in London over the killing of Mark Dugan. I have witnessed protests here in Nairobi. There were protests just yesterday morning. A police officer killed someone in Mogadishu last month and people were protesting and rioting. Last year, when there were the uprisings in Sudan, armed forces and police were killing and raping women, girls, the elderly, everybody that couldn't protect themselves. Across cultures, darker people suffer most. Why? This is the question that Andre 3000 put on a black jumpsuit, and I have been thinking about it for years. There's a lot of rhetoric online now about how it isn't black people's responsibility to explain what is going on to white people. I agree 100% that I or anyone else should never have to explain their humanity or right to live to anyone. That right there is a God-given right. It's a human right. And for anyone who doesn't fully understand that, quite frankly, isn't mentally all the way there and is on the side of white supremacy. And I know that the word white supremacy conjures images of the KKK in people's minds, and a lot of white people will be like, oh no, that's not me. White supremacy is the belief that white people are superior to people of other races and therefore should be dominant over them. It doesn't have to be overt racism. It doesn't have to be you calling someone a racial slur. It could be living in your subconscious. And there are many people who hold prejudices and beliefs that fall into this realm. I saw a photo just 2 days ago of two white Belgian girls in the Congo during colonialism. Now, these girls can't be more than 9 years old. And they're in their backyard with these huge smiles on their face. And in the caption of the photo, it states that they're with their Congolese pet. Ladies and gentlemen, the pet that is being talked about is a young black Congolese boy in a cage. What do you think happened to these girls from 1953? Because they're most probably still alive. They grew up. They had their kids, who now most probably have kids. Do you think that these events don't shape young children? I'd read some article, like, I think 2-3 months back or something, and it was talking about how in the world that we live in, it's not enough for children to be raised by parents that aren't racist. Parents have to actively be teaching their children about race, because black children are never afforded the luxury of ignorance is bliss. And the implications that come with their skin color when they live in the societies that they live. They are always conscious and hyper aware of what their color means. So yes, white parents need to be actively ensuring that their children are anti-racist, because this is what happens. Children spend more time outside of their homes than they do inside of their homes. And clearly, a lot of the societies that we live in have been built on the bloodshed of black people, on the brutalizing of black bodies. And so the people that they interact with, you can't be sure, don't hold prejudices that may taint their minds. So guess what? At home, there are jobs that need to be done, not just with children, but with your spouse, with your partner, with your cousin, with your aunt, with your parents, with your sister, with your brother. That is your responsibility as a person that is not black. And by no means do I think that people can't be redeemed, but if the past week has shown us anything, it's that even with all of the information in the world laid in front of people, many people still don't get it. People do not get it. And as someone who has spent a lot of time in the realm of advocacy and campaigning for about 18 years of my life at this point, this is the most frustrating part of the job. But it's necessary, because nothing changes if people aren't on the same page. If the right people aren't elected in, if people aren't using their privilege to be allies, if people from all parts of society aren't supporting each other and working together, we are not getting anywhere. And it's as simple as that. Now, two words that are associated with advocacy and used interchangeably and that you guys might be seeing a lot is organizing and mobilizing. They are not the same. What we are seeing in many places across the world right now with protests and rallies, this is mobilization. People rallying together with allies to raise awareness of an issue and demand for a set of results. It happens quickly. It can result in reforms taking place, but it is temporary. People cannot be out there protesting for the next 6 months. It's not sustainable. Organizing, on the other hand, is permanent and it's eternal. It is people coming together and saying, I want lasting change. How can we plan and strategize and set goals for that to happen and to stay? Like the Black Lives Matter organization publishing their demands and wants for Black people from this momentum, like the NAACP has done. This creates revolutionary change because you tear up rotten foundation, you burn the system, and you begin afresh. This is the struggle. I personally believe that organization and mobilization are both needed for revolutionary change. Because right now, we're protesting. We're putting up hashtags. You've shared your photos. There's a lot of digital activism going on. And that also comes with people that do it all the time. And that is great. And they're part of organizations. And I salute you all. But then for the general public, what will you be doing 2 weeks from now? A month? 5 years? And the reason I ask this is because it's easy for our mobilization to be reduced to a single event or moment or hashtag, right? But I think Kwame Ture put it perfectly. The struggle is never an event. It is a continuous, eternal process. So we need organizers to do the mundane but necessary work to bring order and to channel the energies out there towards calls for action. The mobilizing we're seeing happening right now is showing us the potential of power in masses, people who collectively reimagine a new future. And this is also very necessary to continually generate hope and to reinvigorate it when the organizing gets tiring. So if you're someone who sees issues within your community or in your society and you want to create change, what I've found time and time again through organizing my community or helping and training other communities that I share a common vision with is that when you meet people where they are and you approach them with respect and warmth and you acknowledge what they're saying and you really, really listen, you get an opportunity to change how people think. And the minds that have to be changed are usually the ones you don't want to sit down and listen to. People who may not have nice things to say about you, people who may even berate you, but especially when it comes to issues that are being voted on, issues that pertain to people's livelihoods. You need to think about the greater good and not your temporary bruised ego or frustration, because as much as it's your fight, it's everybody's fight, and we need to do it the right way. So you can set up a meeting with your community. You can get people together who are like-minded. Listen to people. Clarify common goals that you want to achieve. Frame strategies for action. Choose members of the community that have skills that you may not have to be part of the organizing efforts. Help build leaders and train people and build their capacities. Mobilize your community and pay attention to moments of momentum and change that you can leverage. These are some of the thoughts that have been on my mind for a while, and I hope that they have at least had you thinking a bit. Because there is no such thing as people agreeing on everything, but I would like to think that the vast majority of us agree on the fact that George Floyd and so many other innocent people have had their lives taken away in such violent and inhumane ways, and that cannot be the world that we allow to exist. It cannot be what we just look at and become desensitized to. Now, race-based trauma and stress are serious public health issues, and they can trigger depression, anxiety, inability to sleep, apathy, and avoidance. We are doing a lot of scrolling down our social media feeds and continuously getting triggered by the videos and just extreme emotions coming at us. And it is important for each of you to consider your own self-care when you are feeling overwhelmed. So I've put together a list of self-care tips over on my Instagram account, which is at Qali Eid, so at Qalicid. Everything will also be linked in the description for this episode. I've also been continuously sharing resources for if you want to learn more about the different injustices that are going on, if you want to know where you can donate, if you want to know what you can do in terms of mobilizing or organizing. All of these things I've been sharing on my social media accounts, so you can head over there and check it out. My email and direct message is always open in case you need someone to listen. They're open for questions, general banter, whatever it may be. Just hit me up if you need. And wherever you are listening from, I pray that the heaviness gets a bit lighter for you and for all of us, and that we can all strive to build a world that is safe and equitable for everyone. Until next Wednesday, beautiful people, peace and love. Bye.